This is Suit Up Sports. Where opinions are as sharp as a tailored suit. No fluff, no gimmicks, just unfiltered, hard-hitting takes on sports and a whole lot more. It's time to suit up. Now here's your host, DJ The Suit Stout.
Welcome to Suit Up Sports. I'm DJ The Suit Stout, along with 10-year NFL vet Frank Garcia. Frank, how you doing?
I'm doing great, bud. Thanks for having us again, and looking forward to another great episode.
Great weekend of college hoops, man. The Sweet 16 into the Elite Eight didn't disappoint. If you're a fan of favorites,
no, that's right. And it was interesting to see how many SEC teams were there and how competitive they were. And kind of still what remains, in the tournament. The SEC has been dominant this year, and I think that's really the thing that stood out. They're battle tested. They played great. I think almost every one of them. Were down at some point and found a way to fight through that and, showed their tenacity and their toughness. And I think, that's what it takes to win a championship. It's not only the skill. I think a lot of these teams left have all the skill in the world, but it really just comes down to, toughness and the confidence in your teammate going out there and winning in some of those games. And I know you had a great opportunity that I want to hear all about.
Yeah. So Thursday night, I met a good buddy of mine for a couple cocktails and went and watched his son play lacrosse. And after the game, we went back to get a little something to eat and we started talking. And he said, "Hey, man, I may be getting a plane. Do you want to go to the Duke game in New Jersey tomorrow night?"
Just matter of fact.
Yeah, just out there like, you want to go to the game?
And I'm having a couple of drinks and all of a sudden like, "Hey, let's fly out of here."
Yeah, I guess one of his kids goes to Alabama and they had talked about that. And then his other son, obviously he's rooting for Alabama because his brother's there. And I was like, "Well, yeah, man." And he goes, I said, "We get tickets. We need the tickets, what we need." And he goes, "Nah, I got it all covered. Don't worry about it. I'll send you the plans in the morning."
That's a good friend.
Great friend.
I need some friends like that.
Yeah, he's a great friend. So I said, "All right, so I'm in." So we got on a little plane Saturday afternoon.
Little plane.
A King Air, to be precise.
A little plane.
And we flew to Newark, New Jersey. We landed, had a car service pick us up, bring us right to the arena. And it's in the middle of Newark, New York. So first of all, if you don't know a lot about Newark, New Jersey, for years and years, it was the murder capital of the world. Like, not kidding, like bad. And
what's
so
changed?
Well, they're trying to put all these new bars and restaurants and condos and this arena in the middle of it and try to, rejuvenate it, for lack of a better word. And so the arena was beautiful and they've got some bars and restaurants near there. So we got there in time to, have a couple of drinks before we went in. I was looking at the weather before I went to the airport and I thought I'd flipped it over to Newark and I had not. So I thought it was gonna be 82 degrees there, which in my head didn't make sense at the time. So I'm wearing like a golf shirt. Oh, I was freezing when I got there, but, we go inside, long lines getting in, we get in there, merch line had 1,000 people in it, but they had the arena there had all cool bars and huge TVs and everybody's out there obviously watching the Florida game.
It's funny how many cities they're doing that in now. Like, they're gentrifying, the tougher parts of town. And they've done that in where I'm from, Phoenix, Arizona. They've done it in multiple different places, and that sounds like what they're doing it there. So
they are, and
it's like a one-stop shop, and everything is right there in the heart of it.
Yep, and the New Jersey Devils, their NHL team, that's where they play all their games. So we get in there, and everyone's gathered around these TVs watching the Florida game. And when we walk in, I think there's 8 minutes left.
Was this the Elite Eight you're watching?
We're watching the game. Florida was down and went on an 18-4 run, I guess, with 3 minutes left, minutes left. So we're watching that. I have Florida to win, I think, two of the three pools I'm in. I had bet Florida to not only win, but also in the second half, which I lost that part of the bet. But anyway, so I'm watching this game, and Florida was just an unbelievable comeback, win the game. And then we go to our seats, right? And there's about 14, 15 minutes ready for the Duke game. I love college basketball. It's just the pageantry, the fans, the bands, the cheerleaders, the mascots, everything about it. It's just got an electricity that you don't feel when you go to an NBA game. And then that's not even a knock at the NBA game, but it's just not even comparable.
It depends, right? If you've been to NBA, and I know you have, when you go to an NBA playoff game,
playoffs are different, yeah.
And playoffs are absolutely completely different. The buzz, the excitement, the ambiance, and an NBA playoff game versus regular season, I will agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
It's almost like we're just there to watch, you know, a couple minutes, and if we leave, we're not missing anything.
Yeah.
We're looking there to see maybe, you know, the cheerleaders or
friends you might know.
We're looking around, so you might see a movie star or a celebrity something like that. So, but when you go to these college games, what I still love, and I'm thankful that I was able to watch not just the games and how hard they played, but the press conference afterwards.
Yeah.
Right. And it's great to see the connection that some of these players have with their coaches and how much passion they put into, you know, their craft.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you lose and you feel like this might be it, that's your last time, definitely gonna be the last time you're with your teammates there. That team is gonna never look the same again.
Yeah.
Because you can have one or two guys leave, you might have one or two guys come in, even if you're still there the next year. It'll be the last time you ever play with that group of guys. And you know, that means something. It meant something to me, and I'm sure it's going to mean something. And I'm glad to see that meant something to a lot of these, almost all of these players. The emotions that go through with the agony of defeat and the excitement and the thrill that goes on with the victories.
Well, yeah, I mean, and to your point, Alabama had four of their starters were, you know, graduate students or on their fifth year or whatever. So, yeah, that team will be brand new next year. And Nate Oates, I'm sure, will refill it because he knows what he's doing. He's a great coach. But we're sitting down and, you know, the bands are both there. And, you know, I love hearing the college bands getting you fired up. And the one thing that did tick me off a little
was it a big arena?
It's big. I mean, I think it seats like 19,000. So
it's a big basketball
and it very steep.
And it wasn't one of those like Coliseums where, you know, you go in there like a football stadium and you get swallowed up with the basketball.
No. It was great.
I've been to those two, like Indianapolis Dome when they did the Final Four, you know, back there years ago. It's like you're sitting at the top and you need glasses to kind of, you know, just see the players and look like specks up. And you got
seats. We had great seats. We were on the foul line about 10 rows up. And and this arena was very conducive for basketball. It was great. But they had a DJ, which a lot of arenas do that now, where they have a DJ between, you know, during timeouts, whatever. And the DJ was just rocking. And the sound system in this place was unbelievable. However, the bands were playing, and this DJ is going nuts, and I couldn't hear the band. And so, like, I wanted to just do, can you at least, like, shut up for 2 minutes, let the band play, and then go back to your DJing or whatever you want to call it? And so that was the only thing that drove me crazy. But the crowd was great. The Alabama fans are great. You know, the Duke fans were obviously 85%
fans. It was a home game for Duke.
Yeah, I mean, blue. You saw a lot of blue there. Ken Jeong, the famous actor who went to Duke, that was in Hangover and all
those. But did you die?
Oh, but did you die? He was there, and they put him on the camera, and he did some funny stuff.
Have you seen his little skit that he does when he's on he's talking to the guys, and he said, "Oh, he's saying hi to the
guys." Yeah.
He goes, "What's up?" I went, "Oh, that's just your last name." That's hilarious.
Yeah. He's funny, man. He was a doctor, dude, which is crazy. Yeah. But the fans went nuts.
And he went to Duke, I think.
He went to Duke, and the fans went nuts when they showed him. And then you know, the teams are coming out, and then they did let the bands kind of play a little bit, and they're warming up, and the game started. And I told you this before the show. When you watch Duke play on TV and you read the stats and you hear the announcers say that Duke's average height is 6'7", and all those things, and which is all true, seeing it up close and personal is a different ball game, man. Like, first of all, Alabama's two guards who had just set records almost the day before did set the record.
I mean, one guy was one way from the all-time record, but they had
25 total,
which is the record, and they scored more points than anybody in the Sweet 16 ever has done.
Right. So they come out, and, you know, obviously, as a Duke fan, you know, you got to stop those guys. And seeing those guys that are 6 foot, 6'1", guarded by guys that are 6'5", 6'6", like Sion James, for instance, who can move, who's fast, who's strong. And then if they do get penetration, having Maliwach in there, Ogumba in there, just swatting balls away. I'm telling you, the size that Duke has is going to be the biggest problem that anyone that's left. I think I looked at it. I think Auburn's the only team that has
guard size.
And Duke's still taller,
big guys down
their
low.
Guards are at least bigger.
Veteran play, they're older, yeah. So,
and Florida is not too far behind either, and that's who we both think will be playing Duke. But Seeing that size up close.
I don't know, man. Go ahead. Finish your. Yeah.
Seeing the size up close was one thing that really struck me. And then the other one, again, this is not a, I'm not revealing a secret. We all kind of saw this watching the games, but seeing it in real life was how many guys on Duke can handle the basketball with ease. And when teams press them, they beat it with ease.
Well,
they can
throw right over the top of them.
They can throw to the top or just handle the ball. I mean, Cooper Flagg really didn't have a great game. He had some bad turnovers. He got stuffed on that dunk. But towards the end of the game, who's handling the ball the entire time? Cooper Flagg.
Yep.
And if they double him, then he's getting to Sion James or to Proctor, who's 6'6", which a lot of people don't know that he's that tall. So, like, those two things, seeing it up close and personal, really that you don't see that on TV as well as you do up close. Now, you know, I don't know if they could have played defensively much better. And Maliwatch is just becoming a superstar right in front of us. I mean, that kid, and you talk about big, like he is huge out there. He dwarfs all of them, mm-hmm. and he's starting to really get it. And so.
Well, I think that, obviously from where he was at the beginning of the season mm-hmm. to where he's at right now, he's probably grown the most of any player on that court.
Yeah.
Because he didn't really have a lot of experience playing, you know, this
guy. He'd been playing for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, he's only been playing for a limited amount of time. A lot of these kids grow up, as you know, since they're like 4 or 5 years old playing in NAU and, all the other things that they do is full-time basketball. And, here you have a guy, and not only is he getting better as a player, more confidence, I think the team is starting to run plays through them. And, what are you going to stop? And I think that's where Duke is the biggest mismatch problem. If their outside shooters of Proctor and Knipple are hot or even somewhat, warm.
Or James.
And they have so – I'm not even talking about their bench yet, right? I'm just talking about the starting guys that they have with their starting five. And then the other guy that's coming along is the linebacker that –
That's James. Starting now.
He is a physical mismatch for anybody that's playing against him.
Yep.
And he can bring the ball up.
Yep.
He's a good guard. Now, when you're playing a team like Bama, right, and seeing this game, to me over the weekend, that was probably the most biggest misses or the most comfortable wins other than maybe Tennessee-Houston. And I was extremely disappointed in Tennessee. But, for Duke to go out there, and I know there was a lot of concern from what Alabama did the time before, and I know you wanted to play them because you didn't think they were going to be able to replicate. Maybe you did.
No, I didn't think they would. That's why I was glad.
But I think the thing that we talked about is that when you're looking at matchups, Duke is going to have the ability to match up against smaller, mm-hmm. quicker, right? Because their big guys play smaller and quicker. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to say that you can't match us on the offensive side, we're just going to throw it down low with those guys. You're not going to get your shot off on the defensive side. I mean, they are the biggest mismatch team, left in this tournament. And it's just going to come down to, I think, because first time in like 25 years or since what year was it that all four number ones made it?
Oh, it's been a long time.
It's been a long time. And it's only ever happened once. So this is the second time ever that all four number ones have been in the final four. So all the things that we talked about before, with should Carolina get in? Should this team get in? Should that team get in? It's really a moot point because it really came down to about 6-7 teams anyways, in my opinion. And those were the only teams that really stood a chance throughout the long haul that could match up with anybody, could play defense, play offense. And it's that Ken Palm ranking that we talked about. And it's amazing to see how many teams left were on that Ken Palm.
Well, what's interesting is I read a stat last night that if you go back and you use the Ken Palm
formula,
if you go back to, I think it was 1993, this Duke team has the second highest ranked Ken Palm ever behind another Duke team. But all
the 2001 team.
Yeah, but all four of the teams in this Final Four are top 10 since 93 in Ken Palm. So,
you're talking about historically. This is only like 25 years, so it doesn't go back to Carolina team.
I think it's 1993.
Yeah, so it doesn't go back to like the Tar Heel team, Jordan and those guys. They would have been number one in my opinion. It might be the greatest team to ever play college basketball, but doesn't put the UNLV team. So it would have had to be a little bit later than that, maybe 95, 94. But your point is that all these remaining have absolutely met the most dominant teams in college basketball this year, offensively and defensively.
100%.
And that's the reason why they're there. I mean,
well, listen, and you know, let's go to who Duke's going to be playing. Let's go to the Houston Tennessee game, which you mentioned. You know, Houston plays really good defense, as does Tennessee. Tennessee, the one thing that we've talked about all year with them is they have games or spurts where they can't score. They can't hit the broadside of a building. And yesterday, unfortunately for them, the first half was that spurt. They couldn't hit a free throw. They couldn't hit a three-pointer. And I can't give all that credit to Houston, even though Houston plays really good defense. Tennessee was missing some open shots as well. I mean, they had early in the first half, they had a prayer for his name, but he missed three free throws. He had missed two, and there was a line violation. He missed the third one. Of course, they get the rebound, and he gets a layup. But my point is, the first half, Tennessee couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And Houston forces them into a lot of that. They did force them into kind of a game I don't think they wanted to play. Houston reminds me of, again, of old, like an older school team. They play real good defense. Kelvin Sampson does a great job coaching them up. I mean, you saw the play that got him into the Elite Eight when they had the great inbound pass that he called during a timeout where they caught everybody by surprise and got the dunk for the win. So he does a great job of calling plays and the team. You know, I told you after the game, I watched his press conference where he talked about how he does not recruit divas. He does not recruit guys that doesn't come from good families, which, by the way, we're starting to hear a lot of coaches say that these days. I mean, Calipari said the same thing about Arkansas. And with the portal, you're going to be able to handpick those guys a lot easier than you used to be when you had to bring a freshman in from high school not really knowing the track record, where now you got a little track record with a portal. But Houston –
giving you a bigger pool to fish in because you no longer have to say, we recruited this guy from high school.
Yep.
We can go out and draft free agent.
Yep. And Houston's – listen, Calvin Sampson been kicking butt with Houston. They've been here. They've been in this position before. I will say this, and I just worry – not worry, if I'm a Houston fan, I wonder if Houston can just score with Duke. I mean, that's the thing. Duke is going to score. And like you said, it's pick your poison. If you want to double down here, then Proctor's going to hit. You want to double over here, James is going to hit. Yeah, they threw four alley-oops to Miley Watch this game, and I think he got three of them. The game before that, I think Flagg threw three by himself. So they're starting to work that in even more. So as good as defense as Houston plays, they're going to have to shoot the ball incredibly well to pull up the upset against Duke. Right now, Duke's only a 4.5-point favorite, which I think against Alabama it was closer to 9. So this is the lowest spread that Duke's had in a while. And again, Houston's a tough team. They could definitely beat Duke, but they're going to have to shoot the ball well because even on a game, Cooper Flagg, like I said, he didn't really play that well. He finished with 16 points and 8 rebounds, but he didn't shoot the ball well. He shot the first 3-pointer of the game and made it. You go, uh-oh, yeah. Here he goes. And then he struggled. I mean, he struggled with shots that he normally makes. Like I said, some stupid turnovers. He just seems
like
a little off.
It's like birdie in the first hole in golf and then figuring out, am I going to have a good round? Or am I going to have a great round? Or am I going to blow it up in the second hole and have the PBFU?
Yeah, well, exactly. And so, he didn't play that great, but Duke has so many weapons that they can throw at you, and he's just going to have to score.
Well, the interesting thing is that, you know, before the season started or, you know, before the tournament started, we were talking about all the teams that have, that have the potential to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think we all think that KenPom ranked the 13 teams that we were looking at and mentioning, and Houston was one of those teams.
Yep.
And I said, you know, it's my fault. I haven't watched much of Houston. Well, I tell you what, I've watched a lot more of them in this tournament.
Yeah.
And we're going to see all we want if you're a Duke fan, that matchup because these guys are tough. They're athletic. They're physical. They're mature. They have a good coach. And they're going to be able to get in Duke's kitchen and, depending on how the game is called, that's what I feel like is going to be, dictate the tempo or the pace of this game. What will be interesting to see is when they play, how much of that is allowed and then how deep are they? Mm-hmm. We haven't talked about Duke's depth yet. Right? Yeah. And in this matchup, you got five guys and they're going to be able to play. It's only 40 minutes in college basketball and you're going to have plenty of time before the game starts. So you can be well rested. But even in the game, when you're giving that much output on the defensive side, right, it's going to affect you on the offensive side with your legs, especially near the end of the game. And where Duke has a better rotation, and I think they have more size, more guys that come off, they can be fresher at the end of the game. So I look for this game ultimately to be a great game, a very hard-fought game, hopefully foul trouble isn't a factor in this game. But eventually, I think because of what you said, there's just too many scores on Duke. And, you know, these guys, they can light it up when necessary. They'll push the pace. They'll get in the 80s if they're dictating that tempo. Mm-hmm. But every coach goes into a game with a mindset. What is going to take away their strengths and play to our strengths? Mm-hmm. We're going to play to their weaknesses and we're going to play to our strengths. We're going to attack their weaknesses and we're going to play to our strengths.
Yep.
And I guess my question would be is that who has the least amount of weaknesses? Where is Duke weak?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. And again, not to be a Duke homer, but that, you know, even buddies of mine who are Tar Heel fans are going, this might be the best team I've ever seen in college basketball. Like, they really don't have any weaknesses. Now, teams like that have lost before. UNLV is one you mentioned. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that they're –
Michigan, I mean, there's a bunch of teams out there that have had all this talent and potential.
Yep.
And I think that's the other thing that I will say is that nobody's talking about Houston. Nobody's giving them a chance, right? But –
And they've been in a national championship more recently than Duke has.
Yes, yeah. And this is a similar group. It's not the same team, but it's a similar team with the same type of coaching. That can they take that next step? It's the dangerous animal that's been hungry playing for a year to get back to where they think they deserve, and that's a national championship.
So yeah.
That's tough to beat.
And look, they're a physical team, and we started seeing this a lot the last time, the last game of the regular season when Duke played Carolina,
yep.
When Carolina got really physical with them up in their grill.
What Arizona did.
Since then, that's kind of been what teams try to do is get physical with them.
Well,
Alabama did it. And
Alabama just didn't have the size.
Well, that's the thing. Houston plays that way. And so Houston is not going to be something that they have to make themselves do. That's how they play. So I think that by itself is going to at least be a nice challenge for Duke, you know, and because they haven't really – they haven't faced a team like Houston. They haven't. Not in months. So this will be a good matchup. And, you know, Kelvin Sampson is a great coach. Shire continues to impress me. I mean, he had a couple timeouts last game where they were, I was yelling, timeout, timeout. And he called the timeout. And then he called great plays. We scored off both of them. Knipple, I think, hit a three off of one. And I think Sion James maybe the other. But he seems to be putting his guys in the right place at the right time. And then even hearing guys like Nate Oates, you know, who I like. A lot of people don't like him. I think he's a great coach. But even hearing the way he talked about Duke and the way he talked about Shire and the way he kind of talked about running out of gas and their size or whatever. So, you know, they're not built to be physical with a team like Duke. Houston is. So this will be a good matchup. The other matchup, though, is one that I think everyone will agree should be a great game where Auburn's playing Florida, two SEC teams. They do not like each other. Florida's had their number this year. And so, you know, we expect this to be a really good game. Florida has, you know, had to squeak by their last couple games. I mean, they turned it on in the second half against Maryland. They come back in the last 3-4 minutes of the game this week against Ole Miss.
Texas Tech.
And Auburn, Broome, who is probably the player of the year, is playing great right now. He looked to be an awful injury to his arm, went back to the locker room, came back in. He says he'll be ready to go next weekend. I hope he is. I hope that everybody's at full strength in this Final Four because, you know, we talked about NIL on the portal and what we don't get because of it, maybe with upsets and things like that. But what we do get, we do have the best teams playing. And so, you know,
I hope
they are at full strength. I hope Broome is ready to play.
I know a lot of people have kind of been down in Auburn. They really haven't been to the place where, you know, they've been dominant like they have most of the year. They probably struggled the most down the stretch of any team, that's left in this group. Everybody else was playing well, winning their championships in their tournament. Auburn is the only one that didn't, and they lost earlier to Florida or to Tennessee as they beat them earlier. So Auburn, I think right now, however, after having those types of games, especially against Michigan State, and maybe Michigan State didn't have that dynamic player that can do things, you know, for them because or maybe it was Auburn and the ability to play defense. Because when I watched all four of these games over the weekend, you know, that's the one thing that, you know, kind of stood out is how athletic and fast how much effort they were putting out on the defensive end. Every one of these teams that is instilled in the way that they play, you know, and that's part of the toughness that, you know, I'm referring to when it comes to winning championships is that now you have to do it when somebody else is on you, and pressure, you know, factors into those things as well. So Florida, I think has had those games. They've gone down the stretch. They've been tested, and they have a good coach. And I think athletically, they're probably as gifted as anybody left in this area, maybe more gifted than even Duke athletically. When it comes to the skill sets and those types of things, I think that and playing together as a team, I feel like Duke is the most complete team. I think Auburn is the second most complete team, right, with the way that they play, the way they distribute, having an inside-out game, Broom being the guy that had a triple or a double-double in the first half of the game against Michigan State. Michigan State hadn't lost to an SEC team. Tom Izzo hasn't lost to an SEC team until they played Auburn, and they played them hard. Yep. They played them tough.
Sure did.
You knew it was going to be a physical game,
yep.
And Auburn answered the bell every single time. Michigan State made their runs. They came close. Auburn gave it to Broom or hit an outside shot with one of their one of their guards and opened that lead back up. So, you know, these teams right now, it's really, really been as much as I didn't really watch or don't enjoy watching regular season NCAA tournament basketball, because you know, football's still going on, a lot of other things.
Like early on season.
Once it got to the Sweet 16 in this tournament, you know, and we were lucky enough to go to Vegas for the beginning of the tournament, and we didn't really see any upsets, right? And we were kind of like, a little underwhelmed. You know, this isn't really kind of what we normally used to see. There's not those buzzer beater shots or that team that 12 going to upset the 5 or something like that. It was more of, okay, good game, close, best team won. That was, when you get to these Sweet 16, I can appreciate these guys for how athletic they are, how hard they work, and you know their ability and the way that they're competing. Every one of these teams has been put together to build a championship, and these four are the last four standing, and rightfully so, because I mean they're the most complete team.
Yeah, and you know, the Auburn Florida game to me is going to be really intriguing because number one, they know each other very well. Mm-hmm. The coach of Florida, I think, was like a coach's assistant or something for Auburn years ago, working under Pearl. So I think it was at Auburn. And so they know each other very well. Like I said, Florida, you know, has the upper hand on them during the season. But Clayton for Florida is, you know, every tournament, there's certain players that maybe you don't know enough about. And then by the end of the tournament, you go, my God, Steph Curry would have been one back in those days. Well, Clayton to me, I mean, I watched Florida play.
Jimmy Butler would be another one.
Yeah, guys who just turn it on And so Clayton to me, I've always thought he was a good player and he could shoot the ball, whatever. And then this tournament, he's just been unbelievable. I mean, he's taking like fadeaway three-pointers when he doesn't even really have to. And you're going, oh, what is he doing? Okay, it's good. You know, like everything he puts up in clutch time has been money. And he same thing happened when they had their great comeback on Saturday night. So these teams know each other very well. The coaches know each other very well. They don't like each other. So the intrigue for me on that game, is I can't wait to see it because I think it's going to be a back and forth, fist fight. And you mentioned the athletes on Florida. Listen, I don't think a team left in the Final Four get up and down the court like Florida. You know, not that Duke can't, not that these other teams can't, but Florida just seems to glide up and down the court with ease.
Well, I mean, Houston has probably had the close, you know, matchup to getting there, except for the Tennessee game in the Elite Eight. But if you go back to that Purdue game, even where the game was tied with about 5 seconds to go, 4 seconds to go, the inbound play that Samson drew up was about as good a play that you're going to be able to find. And, apparently, listening to the experts talk afterwards, Jay Wright was there. I don't remember the girl's name that was doing as well, but she had a lot of experience.
Candace Parker,
smart, intelligent basketball player, and played that position and been in those situations to know exactly, you know, what the play was and how to defend it and how to attack it. And the play was drawn up to perfection. The execution was better than the defense.
Yeah.
That was the difference in that game, is that they executed. And I'm talking about split seconds, getting the ball back to the inbound passer. If that 1 second, the weak side helped get the pass or block that shot. But it happened so quickly, it's like they've been prepared.
Yeah.
And that you knew it, because that's the reason why that they're moving on. But to play games like that, you know, kind of gives you that confidence and belief that this might be our year.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go out there and it gives you that momentum that you're looking for. Who are the teams that are playing the best? And it's not the teams that are going to be blowing everybody out. I mean, they're playing the best, but they've been some mismatches. It's going to be the teams who have, you know, been challenged and tested. And when you look at Houston throughout the tournament, I mean, they had to blow out against, you know, the first team they played, beat them 78-40, and then Gonzaga, 76-81. That really game wasn't as close as what that indicated. Houston had a double-digit lead towards the end. Gonzaga made a nice deep run. I think might even have hit a three late to bring that within five. But that was more like a 10-15-point game. But then you get into Purdue. And, you know, back
Purdue,
and forth.
By the way, there was a foul at the end of the game that should have went Purdue's way. That game could have ended a lot differently if it did. And I know that a lot of Purdue fans and a lot of basketball fans were mad that it did.
You swallow your whistle as refs.
Well, I hope they do that. I hope they do for the most part. But, you know, you're right. Houston has fought through, you know, the last couple games. Michigan State's obviously tough. No one wants to play Michigan State. No one wants to play Izzo in the tournament ever because you know the success he's had in the tournament, and you know that his teams are always going to be prepared and tough. And Houston got through them, and now they get rewarded with Duke. Duke's a 4.5 favorite over Houston. Florida is a 2.5 favorite over Auburn, which didn't surprise me. I thought they'd be, you know, the favorite a couple points, so that didn't really surprise me. But I do think that if I'm having to pick between these two games, that which one will be the one we talk about the most on Monday will be. Or leading into the championship game, I think the Auburn Florida game just could be fireworks. Well, I mean, I really do.
I think all of them could be. It's just that, you know, because of the point differential and, you know, this none of these games are going to be runaways. None of these games are going to be runaways. They're going to come down to whoever makes the plays and executes crucial tough minutes. You know, that's 2 minutes before halftime, and that's the 2 to 4 minutes before the end of the game. And who is executing in those moments? Because that's where teams have made their run against Duke and Arizona in particular. Purdue, you know, being another one against against a team like Houston. You go to the other side, Florida and Auburn, you know, same type of thing. Michigan State tried to come back towards the end, you know, Broome made the play. Broome hit the big shot in coming back in, and it was a wide open, and he nailed it. He knocked it down. So it comes down to – you know, who are those guys and who are the players that are going to step up in those crucial moments when the pressure is bigger and they're going to do one or two things. They're either going to feel pressure or they're going to apply pressure. And, you know, that's the difference between winning and losing for championship teams.
And if you look at star power, right, and you're looking at these four teams, you know, Houston would be the one that you said won't get enough respect or, you know, you're going to hear a lot more about Duke and the three kids that will probably be drafted in the top 10 to 12.
As a player,
picks.
How would that make you feel?
That's what I'm saying. Like, you're going to hear a lot more about the Duke guys. You're going to hear a lot more about Broome, and you're going to hear a lot more about Clayton.
The SEC, the next and the dominant, the Blue Bloods.
So yeah. You know Calvin Sampson's going to have his guys with that chip on their shoulder. Yep. Of they're not respecting us. They're not talking about us. They're not saying that we've got guys who are going to be in the top five in the draft or the top 10 or the next Steph Curry or this or that. I mean, he's totally going to use that as well he should. And so they're going to come in there with a chip in the shoulder. Plus, they're playing Duke. And Duke has pretty much rolled through this tournament. Arizona, like you said, did make a nice run and got it close towards the end. But, you know, beating a team like Alabama, who's a doggone good team, and beating them by 20, you know, they're gonna hear a lot about Duke and a lot about Flag and a lot. I mean, there was shirts everywhere with a flag on it, and then it says Flag. You saw them everywhere, you know. And so. And by the way, he deserves it. The kid's been unbelievable. Even on an off night to still, you know, put up 16 points and 8 rebounds and play defense like he plays, you got to give him credit. But, yeah, Samson's going to have him ready.
Well, I'm looking at – I'm trying to find their losses. And one was to Memphis, and the other one was to – they were back-to-back losses. And, you know, you can understand, you know, maybe a team going through a bad stretch, an injury, you know, might take place, trying to find your identity with this team, you know, type of situation. But, you know, once they have, you know, they've made a pretty damn good
playing,
run.
I think the best basketball they played all year for sure.
Yep.
And you normally would say that about a Final Four team. I mean, you would say that about Duke certainly right now. Florida, I don't know if we would say that. I mean, and Auburn for sure, I don't know if we would say that. But listen, those two teams also have beaten the crap out of each other and gotten beat up every night in the SEC. So, you know, we'll give them a break because they're still here.
If I'm Duke, I'm looking at what Memphis did to them because they gave them all they can handle both games. Obviously, if we're looking at what they did and saying how did they play, what kind of defenses were they using, they limited them to, you know, possessions. They held them down in points, and they beat them pretty handily in one of the two games. Houston earlier on in the AAC tournament got them in overtime by two. But other than that, you know, Memphis kind of, you know, has their numbers.
Almost Penny what Hardaway, seems to be a roadmap.
Yeah,
to,
with Penny yeah. Hardaway, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, Shire, it'll be in his ear. What do we need to do, you know, watching the film? And that's kind of the conundrum as a coach, is that do you really look at, you know, situations and what gave other teams troubles, and you try to implement that? Or do you say, hey, listen, we're going to play to our style and they're going to have to beat us, right? And that's kind of the conundrum that, you know, that Duke would be in, you know, right now. And the same thing for Houston, who beat Duke. It was Clemson, the way they got up on them and played defense. Mm-hmm. You know, and Little John, they were playing, you know, physical. They were playing. Who gave them the tough times? Carolina had the lead going to halftime. How did they play them? They were up in their grill.
Yeah.
You know, they were up in their kitchen, you know, playing great defense. As you said, the style of which these teams are going to play, that already lends to the way Houston plays.
Yeah. I mean,
so the matchup would probably favor, as far as the styles, Duke is going to just have to play their style, right? And if you're the better basketball team, that style is going to impose your will on the other one. And I don't know what really style you implement to beat Houston, you know, but Memphis seemed to have the ticket.
Well, like I said, the one thing that worries me a little about Houston is just I just wonder if they're going to be able to keep up and score with Duke. You know, Florida, if Florida's playing Duke, you know that Florida can score. If Auburn's playing Duke, we know they can score. Houston, I just wonder, can they keep up and score with the Duke team if Duke's hitting on all cylinders, or at least close to that? But we do know there's four great head coaches in this game, so each team's going to be prepared, ready to go.
Are you sold on Pearl?
Oh, yeah. I like Pearl even when he was at Tennessee. And now that he can cheat with the NIL, it's legal. So I think he's going to be even more dangerous. But I like all four of these coaches. And I think that you know, even Golden, who people are just now learning about, you know,
he's probably the newest on the stage. Well, him and Shire was more known as a player than he is a coach.
Yep. And they're both in their third year, I believe, their respective schools.
Shire has, I think he might have the highest win percentage of any coach active right now.
After 3 years, he does.
After 3 years.
And Golden, I don't think, is too far behind him. And, you know, Golden's first year, he took over a bad program. They did pretty good.
Man, we're looking at the next Bobby, Billy Donovan, maybe. and Coach K.
Maybe, you know, I know Florida fans and Duke fans would take that right now.
Absolutely.
If you know, you've got those guys coaching your team for the next 20, 30 years, you'll take it right now. When we come back, we're going to talk to Brett Hoffman from Sleeper NFL and Gator Wages, talk some NFL draft. I know we've been talking a lot of basketball, obviously, during March Madness, but we're 25 days out from the draft, and I know everyone in Charlotte in particular is getting excited. What are the Panthers going to do at number 8? So Brett's going to join us after this, talk some NFL draft.
It's time to suit up. Here's your host, DJ The Suit Stout.
Welcome back to Suit Up Sports. I'm DJ The Suit Stout, along with 10-year NFL vet Frank Garcia. And now on our guest line, I say guest line, I don't even know if it's a line anymore. That's radio talk there.
We have a guest
there.
Line now. Awesome.
Yeah, it's just a guest joining us visually. Is Brett Hoffman with Sleeper NFL and Gator Wages. Brett, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on. And let's talk draft. I've been dialed in. Panthers picks, all picks. Let's get after it.
Well, let's start right there because, you know, Panthers picking at 8. There's so many mock drafts and rumors out there. And, you know, Frank and I have dove into this thing, you know, for the last month or two. And we both have kind of gotten on to the Tyler Warren. You know, if he's there at 8, we both think that it'd be really hard to pass him over, as opposed to taking a shot at one of these defensive ends that early that you're not sure about. And especially with the depth they have at defensive end, you might be able to find one later in the second or third round. But the one thing that everyone are really mocking with the Panthers now, you see Tet McMillan in a lot of these mock drafts. And if you really want to get one of those top 6 or 7 receivers in a weak receiver draft, you almost have to take them in the first round, it appears, if you want one of those top 6 or 7 pass catchers. I know, Frank.
Yeah, but before we get into Tyler, when you answer that question, I want to give you the rationale that I have anyways behind why I feel that way. Because, you know, the Panthers are going to draft a lot for need, potentially. You know, there's going to be a lot of things they have, but they've addressed a lot of the issues that in the offseason with free agency. So it's freed them up a little bit more to have an opportunity to take best player available. And with best player available, I believe that when you look at a guy like that, anywhere he's on the field, he's going to make a difference. Whether he's in the backfield, running the ball, blocking, as an H-back, as a tight end, you can create mismatches very similar to a Christian McCaffrey type of player – in a different position, you know, using size and speed more than just the quickness and things that McCaffrey's going to be able to do. But you, as an offensive player and an offensive-minded guy, I look at a piece like that and I said, he's going to change and make a bigger difference than any other player at the draft, because he's a he's a potential mismatch anywhere on the field. So that's why I feel like you could take him, you know, that early.
I mean, listen, you guys are nailing it ahead on the nailing it. I mean, look, there's just, I'm going to be so real with you. The Jets are picking right before you.
Yeah.
The odds makers, I'm looking at the betting odds, who they're going to pick, favorite position. Tyler Warren is the consensus pick at seven. Like I, like I'm, you know, in the New York community, I see Jets fans, I speak to Jets fans all day. They're all in on Tyler Warren too. So the question for me with the Panthers and Tyler Warren isn't about, you know, the right call, because I think I agree completely with you guys in terms of difference maker. I think he's going to be the offensive rookie of the year. Like that's, you know, that's where I see his immediate value. And I think, like, I think we quickly talked about him last show, but if he is there at eight, I think it's, I'm with you guys, you know, best player available. And also, like you said, you addressed the, you know, other needs throughout the offseason. And you're in position to take best player available, and you got to give Bryce some weapons. Talk about weapons. This guy's a multiverse weapon, and it's an auto pick for me.
Yeah. And, you know, the, like I mentioned with the pass catchers, you know, they're pretty much the consensus is there's six to seven guys in this draft that, that will go in the first or second round that have a chance to be good. There's not anyone that they think is going to be, you know, a Jefferson or a Chase. They got some guys that they think could be. I know that my favorite receiver on the board, not counting tight ends, is Golden from Texas. I like his speed. You know, watching Texas play, he just seems to make the tough catches. He's a tough kid. He's fast. I know a lot of the Panther fans down here are all over Tech McMillan. That's the guy they love, you know, 6'4", ran a, what, a 4.5 or a 4.45 or something like that. I lean towards Golden, but like I said, if you stay at eight, and I do think this, I think the Panthers are very, very, there's a very good chance they're going to trade down. I think unless there's a Mason Graham there or unless a Tyler Warren there, I don't think they would pick Tet McMillan at number eight. I think they would try to trade down four or five spots and pick up a earlier second round pick than they have right now, which is the Rams pick that we got. And if they did that, then possibly they could get somebody, you know, earlier in the second round. That's one of those six or seven receivers, or even the second or third best tight end at that point. But what are your thoughts on the wide receivers? Are you a big McMillan guy, or am I sniffing on down the right path of
goal? I'm very much in agreement with you. I got Golden as you know, the better overall prospect. I think Golden, you know, when you combine production and the metrics, just really just like over the last 3 months has gone all the way up to wide receiver one. And I'm buying that hype. I also like Luther Burden out of Mizzou. I know,
yeah,
you know, quieter year this past year than 2 years ago. But, you know, the skill set's all there, and he could be one of those major regrets that teams have. I'm going to talk about the tight end. I also like Kyle Williams, like guys like, you know, in the third round too. Mm-hmm. I'm not as high on McMillan as others. You know, he reminds me a little bit more of like a Vincent Jackson, maybe like as his upside, as opposed to like maybe a Mike Evans type. So, you know, if I'm the Panthers and I'm taking a receiver, I agree with you. I don't take any of them at eight overall. I move it back to, I don't know, mid 15, 16, whatever, and grab him there. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And a lot of people think that there's going to be a wide receiver run that starts when Seattle picks. I think they're at 18, if I'm not mistaken, but somewhere around there, they feel that, you know, within that, the next 10 picks, there could be three, four, five receivers that go off the board. So, you know, I don't think the Panthers are going to be in a spot to get one of those guys if they wait. But then again, I'm fine with them not taking a receiver in round one as well. I mean, Dan Morgan says he's pretty comfortable with the receiver room they have now.
I mean, look, so I totally feel that. I'm looking at like just the, like, you know, my three rounds of mock drafts. So you guys pick 57th, right? In the second round?
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, like I like the value in the pass catchers there. Maybe like, you know, like I said, Kyle Williams or, you know, that the kids from Stanford, Ayoman, or in that area. So, yeah. To me, like I'm not reaching on a T-Mac. Like I know you guys need a wide receiver one, but that I like other guys down the board. I really do. And I think they're getting a little bit slept on there in the second and third round.
Yeah.
You know, Brett, let's talk about the quarterback position, you know, just in general. I mean, I don't think the Panthers are going to be looking after, you know, the way Bryce came around, not even maybe for depth. And they've signed, you know, the
Andy Dalton back
as well. So they got pretty good depth in their room. But, you know, when you start looking at a guy like Shedeur Sanders and you see what's happening in Cleveland and you see that Deshaun Watson, you know, is a guy that, you know, has done some questionable things character wise and you know, there's a lot of, you know, I guess disdain for, you know, what's going on in that city right now. Are you going to take a quarterback early, maybe as the second pick, or, you know, because I think the problem, you know, maybe with Shedeur is not necessarily the skill set per se, but it's maybe more of the other things that exist. The, you know, and I'm not going to say he's a bad leader because I've never been in the same room with him, but, you know, kind of the ego and the arrogance that go along with him at that position doesn't lead well for teams, especially a team that's struggling for leadership.
You're right. It's in a tough evaluation when you don't know the guy like you just described. And I would say is I'm of the opinion that there's the Giants at picking at three are in love with him. And I know people may not buy that, and I could be way off here. And that's why I think that there's a lot of Jackson Dart smoke going on right now. I think that that's the Giants trying to sort of – you know, send to Cleveland a message like, you know, we're taking Dart at three, maybe just sends them like a little bit of like a jolt, like what should we do at two? It may devalue like that pick in general, if they were looking to trade even too, if the Giants are all in on Dart, then, you know, it becomes less coveted of a pick to trade up for. Mm-hmm. So my personal belief is, you know, whatever Sanders becomes, he becomes, but I do think that the Giants really like him. And I don't think he gets past the third pick.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're trying to create as many smoke screens as they can. But everything seems to point to that if he's there at number three, they take him. Now, if he's not there, if Cleveland does take him, and obviously Cam Ward's going to go off the board at one, it looks like, to Tennessee. If he's not there, then that really does change the draft, because now the Giants have to decide, you know, do they take Travis Hunter? Abdul Carter will be sitting right there, and they, you know, do you take him, who everyone thinks is obviously the number one defensive end in the draft? So that's where the draft could take its first turn if the Giants don't take Shedeur. Do you think the Jets would let Shedeur get by too? Even, I mean,
it's an excellent question. It's something that I've talked about a lot, and I don't know how they could. I mean, like they certainly need a franchise QB on their roster, and they don't have one right now. So it makes a ton of sense. I don't know if this new GM and new coach with Aaron Glenn, I don't know if they're looking to make their big push there and make their big pick at seven in their first year of the regime. I don't think they are. So I don't think they even want to have that decision on their hands, if I were to really give you a full understanding of that. But, I just think Sanders will be picked by Cleveland. I think it's simpler than most, but that could be if he doesn't, I don't think he gets past the Giants.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Talk about a guy like Travis Hunter, Shador's, you know, a teammate. And when you turn on the film, you see all the intangibles that you're looking for, right? You see, you know, the great awareness, the great ball skills, you know, has a great coach, the upbringing, all the things that go along with when you watch the game and you watch them play. But the measurables were a little bit disappointing. He didn't have the top end speed that maybe you expected. And, you know, what is your thoughts with a guy like Hunter, who a lot of people thought might be the best athlete coming out of this draft?
It's a great one. I mean, a very polarizing subject. I think that a team decides on positionally offense or defense, and he's not going to play both sides of the ball. That's just my opinion of it. I think that the best way to deploy Hunter would be receiver. I get it that he's a good cornerback and he could, you know, he's got the ball skills and obviously the speed and all the traits to keep up with these elite receivers, but you know, we're talking about an offensive league here, and, you know, a weapon like him, he kind of reminds you a little bit of OBJ, you know, in terms of like the ball skills, in terms of recognition and high pointing and the speed. But I think he's going to be an incredible wide receiver. And I don't know which, obviously we don't know which team gets him yet, but that's when the draft really gets going. You know, that's, mm-hmm. that 2-3 pick, you know, that's when the juice is going. And then there's a little bit of a lull in the action almost kind of when we, excuse me, when the Jets go and the Panthers go, it's not as high, it's going to be interesting. You know, those few top picks will obviously decide how we, the Jets and the Panthers go.
Yeah, let's dive into – I want to dive into defensive line as well as corners, but let's start with defensive line because, you know, if the Panthers stay true to what a lot of people think before free agency in particular, now that they have filled a lot of those holes, they don't have the pressure, I think, to feel like they've got to take a defensive player. But let's assume they do, and let's assume that they're looking at the defensive line, and let's assume that Mason Graham is not there, which probably won't be. Out of the defensive ends that were, I mean, you know, the two guys from Georgia, there's about five guys there that they really have to, you know, the two guys from Texas A&M.
Yep.
How do you look at or rank those guys?
And before you finish, let me piggyback off of something real quick, because I want you to add to this as well, because, it was a question I was going to have, so we can just combine it into one. Sure. When you look at these guys and talent wise, obviously the talent's going to be there for any one of these guys in the top 10, top 15 picks. How much does fit come into scheme with your talent? Because you look at these smaller defensive ends, if I play a 4-3 defense and I need an end that's going to stand up against the rush, he doesn't really fit what I'm going to do as an every down player. He's going to be more of a specialist coming off the bench, a guy that can, but if I'm playing a 3-4 or some sort of odd defense where I'm dropping or rushing, now that might be a better pick for you as an organization. So factor that into your response when you're talking about these defensive ends for the Panthers.
No, and I think it's a really good point. And I think that a lot of that traces back to having the same GM and same coach. That's the really how the good teams operate. Like, you look at a team with a lot of turnover, at the HC or the GM position, you're not going to build out that, you know, system that you just described, where you're drafting based on your philosophy and your scheme. So
identity.
Exactly. Look at the Jets. Like, Aaron Glenn is only talking about that word, identity, and, you know, building an identity. So they're going to be drafting guys that are, I guess, you know, junkyard dogs and football lifers who are just studying tape, hopefully, all day. So I think that scheme and you know, that plays a massive part, a little bit maybe more on certain positions than others. You know, some guys are just, this guy's a dude and we just need him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in terms of like, you know, your, you know, DJ, your initial question of which guys Panthers could target there. It's interesting to me. Like, it almost seems like if they do take a defensive like rusher, like an edge rusher there, it's a little bit of a reach. Like, it's just a slight reach, because like, it looks like, as you described, like a Mikael Williams or like a Mike Green or like a Jihad Campbell or Shamar Stewart. To me, all those guys could be good and will be solid, but they're all in like that mid first round bracket. So not to say if you could nail that pick at 8, who cares? You know, like,
right,
a few picks early. I would say is a big name to watch out for the next month, or even a little less than a month now, is Mike Green, because, you know, it's a polarizing situation of a guy that could be an absolute game wrecker, you know, to a point where he's got serious stuff to, you know, answer to. And, no one's doubting the seriousness of that. So, I think on my first time, came on with you guys, the first pick that I still am sticking with you guys, I know it's just jumping to the cornerbacks, it's Jade. I just keep mocking Jade to the Panthers. It's just something that just fits like a glove for me every time I do it. But you guys can tell me if I'm mistaken there.
No, I mean, listen, the Panthers obviously signed J.C. Horn to a new big deal at their quarterback one position. They brought Michael Jackson back, who was their starter across from him last year. They brought him back on a new free agent deal. So they've got their two starters in place. The rookie Wade that they got in the fifth round last year from Washington State worked his way into starting at slot and played well until he got hurt towards the end of this year. But corner is definitely a place where they need some depth for sure. So I don't think it would surprise anybody if they did take a corner at 8. But again, I think that also lends itself to trading back a little bit. Like, I think they're in a perfect position to trade back. Now, look, Green, you're right. I mean, Green, to me, when you watch tape and his workout at Marshall, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it was ridiculous that this big dude's moving like that. And all the measurables are there, but he has the two issues that have happened in high school and whatever. Now, I also heard a couple GMs anonymously say that they're fine with that now, that the kid has come out, he addressed them in his press conference, he took every question in private meetings. They've had, you know, every NFL team has their own,
Pete, the background checkers.
So right. I have heard that a lot of teams now are okay with what they've learned, and that what he was saying was the truth and whatever. That'll remain to be seen. He's the one that I think if the Panthers took it eight, would probably be a surprise, but it would be one of the surprises that you go, oh man, let's just hope he stays out of trouble because he could be a dog.
Upside risk reward.
Yeah, and
you know what? It's a very interesting point. I want to ask you guys a question because I think about my, like, I'm a Jets fan, and we, like, when if the Jets were to say draft a guy like Mike Green, mm-hmm. you know, the New York media is just going to destroy this guy. My question to you is, Carolina is a much chiller place, and I much rather, I'd rather live and play there.
yeah.
You know, I love the Carolinas. But, you know, if you guys drafted a guy like Mike Green, like, you could get away with it, and it could be a little bit less of a bigger deal. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things in years past as well that, you know, players are very lucky to come here because, you know, having been on the radio and, you know, things of that nature where you see the media, we don't really attack those guys as much as they would in other big cities, Philadelphia, New York, you know, some of the tradition and history that goes in there, the passion that does, like, this is a very melting pot city. So mm-hmm. there's going to be a lot of Jets fans up here. There's going to be a lot of New York fans, and they're going to pick the Panthers, but they're going to root for their Jets, right? They're going to kind of fall into that. So because of that, I think that you have a much bigger buffer if you take a guy as a risk guy, upside guy, versus you take a guy that you just everybody in the city loves.
Well, and I'll say this to that. Now, I think the fact that you know we have new ownership over the past, you know, however 5, 6, 7 years. Dan Morgan's new regime with the general manager. This is the first offseason that we have had that continuity that you talked about, where we kept our defensive coordinator, our offensive coordinator, and all those things. Under the old regime, you know, I don't think the Panthers probably would have taken a chance, because you got to remember some of the horror stories that we've had here with Ray Carruth and then Fred Lane getting shot by his wife, and there's several others we can go on and on about. So I don't know if they would have risked it back then, but I think under this new regime, where, you know,
well, how much do they trust Dan Morgan is really what
that's
saying.
That's what I'm saying. I think they trust that Dan is going to do his homework. They, you know, some of the words that Aaron Glenn uses there in New York are the same words that Canales and Morgan are using here, where they want dogs, they want football guys. That's another reason why I think Tet McMillan won't be their pick, was because just this week he came out and said he don't like watching film. He don't watch film. And so, like, first of all, his agent probably had a heart attack when he said that. Kind of like the Snow White actress that whatever she did to ruin that movie I keep reading about. But he probably had a heart attack when his client said, I don't like watching film. That by itself, to me, would make the Panthers go, no way. Because they want dogs. They want guys that want to watch film, that you got to kick them out of the film room.
I got to be honest. Who would want that? Like,
yeah.
I mean, the skills are obviously good. Like, you know, he's obviously got the talent and the athleticism to be a player. But I obviously think that drives serious red flags. You know, I don't know the context of that video. I did see it. I don't know if it was taken a year ago or taken last week. So I want to dig into that. But I mean, for him to say it, he sounded pretty serious. And, like, he just doesn't seem like he's a gamer. Like, and if the problem is like, there's too many of those people who are so hungry. Like, the guys that will do anything for a job, and, like, their families are just saying, you know, keep working. Like, you're there. They're supporting them. And there's so many guys that would die for a chance. So when you see a guy like Tet McMillan, who's, like, almost taking his opportunity for granted, to me, it's concerning. And, you know, I already had him ranked, you know, as my fourth receiver. And I'm just not going to really budge off that right now.
Well, I'll say this, Brad, as a guy that has been in those locker rooms as a veteran player, I want guys that are serious about winning, because they're costing me bread.
Yeah.
Right. So,
Frank, I was totally going to say that to you. I was like, how would you go about a player like that? You know,
I mean, and I've played with guys like that, and they don't last very long. On top, they might last because of their skill set in the league, but they're never really going to have the impact, and they're always going to be viewed as an underachiever holding us back. So I hope that kid is taken a little bit out of context with what maybe he was asked with that question, because I know a lot of times that can be the place. Or I hope that he goes to a team for his sake, that he gets a veteran player that grabs him by the neck and pulls him in here and said, listen, either you're going to do this our way, and this is the way we do it here, or you're not going to be here. And you're not going to have many friends. And we're going to be asking if you're asked to leave.
I mean, that's what I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and we're talking with Brett Hoffman from Sleeper NFL and Gator Wagers. And, you know, back to that team culture that we talked about, that Dan Morgan and Dave Canales have preached that they want. When you do take a guy that may be a little bit of a risk, you see teams that have great cultures are the ones that always take risks. You see the Patriots would take guys like that. Kansas City. Now, Kansas City, it's bit them in the butt a couple of times. But teams that have great cultures, great head coaches, great GMs that are all on the same page seem to be the ones that are a little more comfortable taking those risks, and they normally pan out. So if Dan and Dave are on line with where they want to be, and they sound like they are, and even listen to the players, I forget, was it like a month ago, they do an anonymous survey about, you know, what do you think about coaches and players and ownership? Well, our ownership gets like a D+ every year. Well, this year, Canales, I believe, got like an A.
And well, let me say this to your point right there. And again, I've been on both sides of this. I've been on teams with great leaders, and I've been on teams with just guys that are trying to survive and keep a job, right? Because they're, you know, they don't have the identity that we're talking about. When I was with the Rams, every position group had a Hall of Fame leader that worked the hardest, and they grabbed those guys.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use Adam Archuleta as a guy that came in, but we didn't need to. He was a guy that already bought into, I got to work harder than everybody else. But I've also seen other guys that have a lot of talent and have a lot of potential. If you have a veteran-led team with a veteran coach and established, you know, GM that have identified their culture and they have an identity, that kid has nowhere to turn other than to buy in.
Yeah.
If you go to a place that's unestablished, that's fighting, and that's what's usually happening with these first, you know, five, six, you know, picks, seven picks, eight picks, they don't do a very good job with their leadership. They don't do a very good job with their culture. And that's the reason why they're picking 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5.
Yeah, every year it's somewhere in there. You're right. Let's get into tight ends just for a minute, because I know we talked about Warren, and you're probably right. He probably won't be there when the Panthers pick. And even if he is, who knows if they take him or not. The Panthers have done a great job this year in particular of keeping everything close to the vest. I mean, there's been no leaks, and I mean, they really have, which has been great. But give us some of the other tight ends that might be available, you know, with that second pick late in the second round or the third round or fourth round that you think would be, you know, a good value there that could be a player.
No question. So I do think that just there in terms of like the tiers, it's Tyler Warren, and then there's the drop off. So I will say that there is a big drop off in my opinion from 1 to 2, but two other guys that I, you know, there's a few. I'm a little bit like, I'll start with a guy who I'm a little lower on than others is Colston Loveland. I think, you know, he's projected the Michigan tight end. I think he's projected to go late first. There's been other tight ends that have simply just to me over the last month passed him by, like Mason Taylor, the LSU kid. Tests are great. He has the pedigree. His dad's Jason Taylor. His uncle is Zach Thomas.
Yeah.
So, you know, this kid's a lifer. And he's obviously, you know, LSU pedigree. He's got the skill set. I also like Terrence Ferguson, the Oregon tight end, a lot. Think he's projected to go, you know, anywhere, you know, maybe second, mid-second to third. So in that flex area. And then the last two, three other guys I'll just quickly name. Gunnar Helm, Texas, maybe a fourth rounder, watch out for. Harold Fannin, people really like, possible third rounder. And then the last guy, Elijah Arroyo, Miami. Flashed a lot of potential with Cam Ward. So people are kind of high on him too.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're sitting here talking about identity and you know, legacy and trust and all the things with management. And Dan Morgan's name has come up quite a bit. When you start looking at what he's done here, not necessarily in free agency, because I think a lot of people would agree he's hit home runs with the offensive line, putting guys in position. You see visibly the impact that those guys had first year because they're veteran players. So you're going to see it a lot more faster. It's a little bit more difficult to see that with the draft. Xavier Leggett, Jonathan Brooks, Trevin Wallace, Jatavion Sanders, Shaw Smith-Wade. You know, all these guys are going to be maybe 2 or 3 year projects, especially the lower you get down. But none of them really had the impact that they really probably should have had with where they were picked. And especially, you know, Xavier Leggett as a first round guy. So how big is this year's draft? So us as fans can gain a little bit more confidence with Dan Morgan in the draft.
Yeah, no. So, Frank, which is, I totally understand your point. What's your question there? My apologies.
Yeah. So my question is that what is it going to take for Dan Morgan to do in order for us to get, because we don't know the full impact of these guys yet, or maybe I'm totally off base. Do you think that these guys have a legitimate shot of being playmakers and players in this league?
Yeah. So I 100%. So I actually like Xavier Legette. I think that there's that. You know, he's a rookie. Like, some guys just don't always get it right away. And I'm sure you know that better than me, Frank. So, like, you know, there's going to be a lag period for some guys. But Legette's a second-year guy that I actually really would look out for to break out a little bit. So I like some of those names that you just dropped on me. I'm not sure exactly the production I don't have in front of me of, like, you know, Jatavion Sanders and the other two. But those guys are guys I liked at the draft as well. So, like, I think Dan Morgan is profiling the right type of guy. And I like the way they're identifying their draft classes. So I'm actually like very bullish on like where the Panthers are kind of like headed directionally. I know it doesn't like they hadn't have like a grand slam offseason, but you guys filled basically the main holes. Mm-hmm. And like we talked about earlier, put yourself in position to take your the best player available on you know, Dan Morgan's board, et cetera. So I'm pretty excited about that. And I would say, like, you know, the second year guys, it's a massive year for them. You know, Xavier Legette being one of the probably the key one. What round was he taking? Second round?
We traded up from the second into the end of the first to get him. So
32
we,
overall.
So we get the extra of the fourth year guaranteed. So right. They trade up.
Interesting. Yeah, you don't see that trade a lot for a receiver at 32, but I you know, is what it is. And no, I think you're going to add to it this, you know, in this draft. So you're going to be adding a weapon or two, no question.
Yeah, and you know, Legette, he had a solid year. Towards the end, when he hurt his wrist, I guess the back end of the year, he had some drops that he had not been having. In the red zone, he was tough. I mean, he was really a tough matchup for the teams in the red zone. And again, talking to players on the team, coaches on the team, he's one of those guys that they all say is in the film room. He's trying to get better. I know just the other day, I saw a video of him and Adam Thielen out working right now, working out, catching balls. Adam Thielen loves the kid. And so he seems to be the kind of, you know, cut from the cloth they want. But again, you know, also the first half of the season last year, you know, our quarterback, you know, we had Bryce was awful. And then Andy Dalton came in, had like one good game. And then he was awful. And then Bryce came back and obviously finished the year great. But a lot of people say when Legette hurt his wrist is when a lot of the drops start happening. So we'll see. And, you know, but Frank's right. I mean, he's got to turn out to be a player. You know, Sanders had a really good rookie year. He had a concussion against Kansas City after having a couple big games and wasn't quite the same after that. And then Wallace, the rookie out of Kentucky, the linebacker last year, I thought he had a really good year. He was thrown into starting after, like, what, the second or third game when Shaq Thompson was out. And I thought he had a really good rookie
campaign.
Unfortunately,
I don't think you could say that about any defensive player on that field last year.
Well, there wasn't.
They had a really good year.
Yeah, J.C. Horn might be the only one, I guess, that would qualify that high. But, yeah, on the worst NFL or worst defensive history of the NFL.
It's one thing to be having a great year. It's another thing to be the tallest midget. So.
But
was it historically, like, the worst defense you guys had?
It was, but yeah, so but we're not talking about that anymore.
What are we comparing?
We're moving on from that, and we're hoping that Dan, you know, last year, like Frank said, the offensive line was the worst in the NFL, and Dan fixed it through free agency, and it allowed him to not have to feel pressure to take an offensive lineman early if he didn't want to. This year, he's done the same thing on defense. He's filled a lot of the holes on defense. Not that there's still obviously there's more holes that need to be filled, but he at least put him in a position to where he does not have to go defense. The only position that honestly that would surprise me if they took in the first round would be running back.
Yep.
And that would be it. Like, I don't see there's any way, no way they would take a running back at 8, or even if they trade back. That's the only position. Safety wouldn't surprise me. Corner, defensive line, receiver, tight end. Even if one of the left tackles fall and they trade down, I could see that happening. The only one, if you ask me, I had to bet my house on, I would say there's no way they take a running back. No way.
I was like looking at, like, you know, the odds for like what teams are going to draft, what position. I wanted to pull up the Panthers, but as I do that, I no, you're right. And I also do like Jonathan Brooks too, you know, talking about the running backs, you know,
he'll miss the whole year probably, but you're right. I think the one game he did play before ripping his knee again, he had a couple plays that you just go, man, we don't have anybody that can do that, you know, but he is going to miss the whole year again, unfortunately.
That's very unfortunate. No, I'm just quickly looking at the odds. It's just curious what they say in terms of like what position you guys will probably draft. This is on like BetMGM.
Yeah. I would have to think it would be defensive line.
So yeah, I was somewhere on the defensive side too. Maybe even safety, the kid from South Carolina that we
or Malachi Starks from Georgia, who I love. I think he's the safest pick if we were to take a defensive player at eight. I think he's the safest, can't miss, you know, Pro Bowl every year guy. But while you're looking at that, let me ask you this. So Genty has been a guy that you see all over draft boards. I mean, awesome running back from Boise State, just had great workouts last week. Dude is chiseled. He can run. I mean, you know, he's pretty much, you know, can't miss guy. And, you know, it will be interesting to see that if Cam Ward and Shedeur Sanders are the first two picks in the draft, the Giants are sitting there with Abdul Carter or Genty sitting there. The Giants obviously need a running back. I mean, the rookie Tracy had a solid year last year, but he's not the, you know, the long-term answer. Where do you think the latest Genty, like maybe seven, well, not seven, Jets are going to take him. So five or six Raiders, maybe at five.
I'll say a little later. Let me just say this. I agree with you. The Giants could use it, but the Giants did have the whole Barkley fourth or whatever they took second overall and didn't really pan out. And I just don't know if that's the direction they would go. When I look at the draft and yes, when you get to the seventh pick, the Jets are there. It would be tough for me to see the Jets passing up on a blue chip talent. You know, they can use just blue chip talent, period. Doesn't matter the position. So that's where maybe, you know, I would be surprised. But I'd say, like, in terms of like the highest he could possibly go, probably Dallas at 12.
You know, and I know when you said that Barkley didn't pan out, I know you were meaning for the Giants, not in general. Yeah. Barkley is the best running back in the game.
They nailed the pick.
And I know you know that, but the problem with the Giants, and I think that a lot of people are seeing right now in the comparisons, is that when you have a Hall of Fame quarterback, Eli Manning, you win Super Bowls, and you have some really good defensive players, and you surround them with that. A lot of people feel like the Steelers right now are kind of going through that identity change of losing a quarterback with Roethlisberger, and what's their next step? You try to fill it with a stopgap Wilson, and you know maybe you know some other guys that come in, and you know they're no longer there. You sit here having a next Hall of Fame quarterback with Aaron Rodgers on the market, but you also have the potential because they don't have a quarterback. And after bringing a DJ Metcalf in, what do you do if you're the Steelers?
Yeah, it's one of the funnest questions of the draft to me. So it's definitely. Right now, I have them penciled in at Jackson Dart. You know, like that's where I have Jackson Dart going. You know, so I think that the Steelers fans are. Whenever I post a mock draft with Jackson Dart, they all panic and they all tell me this is Kenny Pickett all over again. So you know, there's internally. You know, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of juice, and I get it. Like it's a little bit of a. You know, taking like an Ole Miss spread out offense quarterback and taking it to a cold weather Pittsburgh. I don't know. So I'm not really all that sold on that fit per se. So to answer your question, it looks like, you know, they're still actively dying for Rodgers to sign with them. I mean, it seems like it's up to Aaron at this point. You know, he's either, I think what he said is he's just deciding do I want to do this or do I want to potentially wait and see if there's a QB who goes down in the first couple of weeks. So I think that's the most polarizing offseason topic right now. And still don't know if Rodgers takes that job. What do you guys think?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting conundrum that the Steelers are in, but also Rodgers feels like he has all the cards right now.
Yeah.
You know, he's not desperate to make money. Somebody is desperate to have him as their quarterback, and a fan base that is used to winning has a lot of pieces. They go out and sign a $120 million guy in their receiver. You better have somebody throwing him the ball, whether that's a rookie. And I'm sorry, Mason Rudolph is not going to be that guy, long term. So do you go get your long term guy? Or here's another potential, option: Jalen Milroe, sitting right there. You talked about the cold weather, and I agree with you completely. You look at certain cities and certain demographics, they play outside, cold weather. The reason why they don't have success with these wide-open offenses is because Weather dictates a lot of those things. Wind, cold, hard to catch, hard to run routes. Running the ball, stopping to run, but having a quarterback, as we've seen the trend, and we all understand it's a copycat league, having a quarterback like Jalen Milroe could make a difference in a cold weather city with a lot of wind with players surrounding him.
I mean, 1,000,000%. I mean, I think that that's a lot of the reason why the Jets just signed Fields. I think that he fits the smash mouth, cold weather brand of football that the Jets should be playing. You know, I go to the Jets games. It's freezing half the year.
That's right.
You know, we're not going to be this, you know, the greatest show on turf throwing the football around like they thought they were last year, obviously. It's not – it doesn't look – it doesn't even feel right. Like, right. It looks wrong. Like, you could just see it. Like, it's just like we shouldn't be playing this type of way. So I think that – I think you're totally right. I think the Jets embrace that and are going to play to that. And I think that it's a big thing when you make a draft choice. Like, you know, a guy just played in Miami for 4 years in short sleeves all day. Is he right. Really easy to kill it with, you know, a cold weather Pittsburgh? I don't know. There's a lot of deep digging you got to do there. And to your Milroe point, I think that second round, like in that third 40 range, like I look for the Saints is my number one list for guys maybe to develop for a year. So I have him right now at 42 or 40, whatever the Saints pick in the second round. And just wanted to make a last point on Rodgers. Isn't it just funny how all these proud franchises fighting for the scraps of the New York Jets?
Yeah, good Lord. I'm a Giants fan too. And man, I don't even want to talk about it. We have had a quarterback in a long time and Daniel Jones and Russell Wilson and Jameis Winston. And that's, you know, and I guess Shedeur Sanders, if he's there, will be there. You know, Aaron Rodgers, my opinion on that is, and I don't dislike Aaron Rodgers. Yeah. I really don't. My gut tells me that his ego and his competitiveness is not going to let him sit out. Like, I think he's going to play. And I think it is going to be.
Well, he still has some. I mean, he had one of his better years last year.
No, I mean, listen, he was hurt most of the year. So I agree with you. But as far as Milroe goes with Steelers, he has to go somewhere where he can sit for a year. There's no question. I mean, Listen, if you want him, I mean, you could have kept Justin Fields, who right now at least is a better version of him. He can run and he throws better right now. Now, we'll see what Milroe does down the road. I mean, I know his accuracy has been a problem, but his measurables are off the chart. I mean, good Lord, watching his workout was incredible. And so I think you're right. I think there are a lot of teams that are going to try to draft him in the second, third round and stash him away. And you know, hopefully it's not the Saints, because I don't want to have to face that guy twice a year with the Panthers. But my gut tells me that Rodgers is going to stay with Pittsburgh or sign with Pittsburgh and probably do it soon. Because, again, if you're the Steelers, you need to know before the draft. Because you need to know, make a higher priority to get a quarterback, you know, or if one of these quarterbacks do start sliding. I mean, you know, look, you mentioned Dart. There's mock drafts that have him going ninth to the Saints. Yep. So, you know, and then you've got guys that have him going, you know, early in the second round. So
and then you've got guys telling you Sanders is a second round pick.
Right, exactly. So there's a lot of different smoke screens being sent out there. Yeah, and
I'm one of them.
Yeah, and Frank's not.
And by the way, there has to be one out of every three guys is going to say it.
I think Sanders is gonna be good, but again, if he does go to the Giants, it's good for him from the standpoint as he won't have to play this year.
Well, yeah,
if he goes to Cleveland,
well, it just depends on what you value as a GM in an organization. Do I value character and leadership, or do I value athleticism and talent? Right? So if I think that a quarterback needs to be a certain quality and he doesn't meet those standards, I'm not going to take him.
Yeah,
if there's one out of three, like you said, there's only so many spots taken. There's only so many quarterbacks needed. Eventually your stock is going to start to draft and other guys is going to start to rise. So I know we're talking about all the sexy picks and you guys love it all, the receivers.
Oh, here we go.
And the running backs and all these foo-foo players. But when you look at the NFL today and you look at the teams that had success, they did it on one side of the ball or on the other side of the ball. And it started in the trenches, whether it's the Chiefs on the offense or the defensive side, the Eagles on the offensive, best offensive line, best defensive line. Hell, they're trying to outlaw, you know, the tush push because it's just an unfair advantage for them, which we could sit here and talk about days for why it's not. But you look at the way that those teams are built up front, hogs, heavy, fast, athletic, big, physical, strong. You know, quarterback hunters, run stoppers, you know, pile movers and road graders. Who are those guys in the draft on the offensive side, the offensive line that could come in and have a big impact for a team that's close.
Yeah. Everyone's all in on Membo, and I'm going to join them. You know, he had a hell of a season. He just ran the 4.6 or 4.7. The guy's ridiculous. He's absolutely a top, you know, 7-8 pick right now based on every, you know, chart that I'm looking at. So I think he's – and, you know, him and Will Campbell seem to be like the top two tackles in the draft. You know, that's where, you know, top 10 potential really lies. There's slowly a little bit of a drop-off. Like – Kelvin Banks, the Texas kid, like, you know, originally was charted as like, you know, a top, you know, 20 pick, slowly moving back a little bit. Like you see like Gray Zabel pop in as like a, you know, potential, like, you know, late first round type. Just like Tyler Booker, the Alabama guard, another really high, you know, people love the kid. So, you know, this is a meat and potatoes draft, you know, as more so on the defensive side of the football. You know, mm-hmm. This is a defensive line, you know, heavy draft. So and, you know, in the trenches, like you just described, is the identity of the championship teams. So building that out is critical. And, you know, look at the best teams. They've been stacking the right picks at that position over the last 3 years. And you look at the bad teams, and they've been missing on those picks. Didn't address it, you know, Giants, the right guy. Giants are, you know, a prime example. They missed on the Evan Neal, and you know, yep. And they killed him. So people – not people. I shouldn't say this. Like, this consensus in the draft when you know, fans are looking at it or we're looking at it is like, oh, offensive line, safe. Like, we just got our guy. You got to be real careful with that because
yep. –
if you miss on that pick, not only did you not address critical needs on the other side of the ball or whatever, but you're just putting yourself in, you know, Bryce Young to get his ass kicked.
Right, exactly. You know, with young quarterbacks in particular. And you know, that, as a Panther fan, you're hoping that both those left tackles go in the top seven, you know, just to push some of those other guys back to you. And they could, like you said, I mean, both those guys, again, you could look at mock drafts that have Jacksonville drafting one of them, the Patriots drafting one. So they both could go before the Panthers pick at 8. And like I said, as a Panther fan, you want that to happen because that just pushes some of the needs, you know, defensive line guys. I mean, if Mason Graham's there, I don't see how the Panthers don't take him. I mean, I think he fits, even though, again, they signed some defensive linemen that are going to help a lot. But that kid, as far as defensive linemen go, in the middle next to Derrick Brown, to me, it's going to be really hard to run against him. But I doubt he'll be there.
No. I mean, you're right. And like, it's important for Dan Morgan to, I mean, I'm sure he knows better than us or better than me, whatever, you know, just because you address some of those players in or positions in the offseason, if that guy slips or if he's your best available player, you're not in any position, in my opinion, Carolina, to say we need a corner or we need this.
Right.
It's not that time yet. We need blue chips, and it doesn't matter where it matters, what position, but let's not put it into so much perspective and let's just grab talent. So that's really where I fall with that.
Yep, I agree. Any other questions, Frank?
No, I mean, he's
I think we covered amazing. Every base.
He's answered all my questions and made me feel good about the Panthers.
I'm a Panthers fan right now. I think.
All right,
I think
awesome. There we go.
I'm joining this Panthers wagon.
Welcome aboard, man. Welcome aboard. They, like I said, if the moves that Dan made this year pay off like the ones last year, especially through free agency, and if Bryce continues to improve like he did, then it should be at least a fun year, at least more fun than that we've had in a long time here as any sports fan really in Charlotte, except for Charlotte FC now, who's kicking some butt. But Brett, thank you for joining us. Tell everybody again where they can follow you on socials.
Absolutely. And thank you guys, DJ Frank, appreciate it as always. You can mostly on X, Brett Hoffman, JR Jr. I also have a YouTube show. I do a lot of NFL draft content. It's called Draft Nights.
Okay.
And, perfect. Hit me up.
Yeah, and we'll send us those. We'll link to it as well from our stuff. And and we're, 25 days from the draft. So we'll have you back on maybe the week before, and because I'm sure will have changed by then. And
we may have a whole different discussion.
No doubt, man. You're probably right. But thank you for joining us, man. We'll talk to you here in a couple weeks.
See you, bud. You guys. Have a great day.
All right, thanks, Brett. So thank you again for joining us. Hopefully we got you covered. NCAA tournament Final Four coming up this weekend, starting on Saturday late afternoon.
Shout out to Brett Hoffman for joining us.
NFL draft, which again, we'll be talking more about that over the next few weeks, 25 days to the draft. A lot of free agents still haven't signed. You mentioned Aaron Rodgers. There's going to be a lot of maneuvering, a lot of smoke screens.
Yeah, well, this is kind of the time right now where, like, what do you watch? I mean, you're sitting there, you just had a great weekend of college basketball. You know the draft's coming up, but it's still a couple of weeks away.
Yeah.
So you were kind of in that dead period of like the anticipation buildup, you know, for Duke and for Houston and for, you know, Florida and for Auburn, you know, but now we're sitting here and kind of in that window. And I know you're a baseball guy.
I was going to say baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, baseball. I mean, and NASCAR. Sunday NASCAR, I've been watching NASCAR every Sunday this year, and which I kind of not watched it as much the last few years. I just thought it got boring. This year, I think it's been a little more fun. My kids are into it a lot, so that's kind of got me back into it. So,
you know what's funny? Neither one of us even thought to mention the NBA. That shows you, shows me anyways, how far, especially after watching what we just saw with the way they're competing, how far the NBA product is falling off of the planet.
Yeah.
We watched LeBron and we talked about, them last week, and we talked about his argument with Stephen A and things like that. But, you know, ultimately, you know, it comes down to you're either the LeBron fan or you're a LeBron hater. And there's a lot of people rooting to see him fail right now, which is not good for the NBA. Because imagine if you're Jordan and you're holding the flag for the NBA, or if you're Kobe and you're holding the flag for the NBA, if you're one of these star players that are supposed to be watching the NBA because of those guys, they're the face of the product, and you got everybody rooting against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that shows you how bad that product has fallen and how little people are watching. I watched a game last night, and literally it was a 3-point shooting competition. It's not even basketball. Eventually, if the clock is running out, they might shoot a layup, they might throw it inside. But I am so sick and tired of watching teams throw the ball inside to a guy 2 foot away, and really all he has to do is go and lay it up. Instead, he kicks it out to 25 feet, 30 feet for a shot.
Yeah, and you know, listen, I'm a huge Hornet fan. I've been going to their games since I was young, since their inception. This is the first year I haven't been to a game.
You're not missing anything.
While we've been doing the show today, I've been offered tickets, and my wife's going, and I've got buddies going to the game tonight. I'm not interested. LaMelo Ball, guess what? He's out again.
Again,
two microsurgeries, and they don't play. So, you know, the Hornets are a great, if you want to paint a picture of what's wrong with the NBA, unfortunately, the Hornets are that. They got a lot of guys that don't play. They don't play back-to-back, or they can't go a week.
How are you going to fix that?
That's a whole nother show, but they're going to have to bring in new players. Like, you got to get guys that want to bring in some dogs.
I'm not just talking about the Hornets, because I think that's not just a Hornet issue.
No, it's not. Totally. It's an NBA issue.
That's indicative of across the NBA.
I don't know how you fix it. And again, that's a whole different ball game, but you're right. I mean, when the playoffs start in the NBA, they normally do tighten up, and then I'll kind of get back in there. Unfortunately, the Hornets aren't sniffing the playoffs yet. I'll be talking the Hornets draft pretty soon, because hopefully they get Cooper Flagg, and then that'll get us excited.
That'll get you excited.
That'll get us excited. But
that's a good way to change it.
Yeah, if that happens, then that'll be a good start. But we'll talk about that probably in a couple weeks when we get into the NBA playoffs, or a little bit longer than that, actually. I think they start in 2 or 3 weeks. But we'll get into that then. Thank you again for joining us. We'll see you Friday talking Final Four.